the creek, where Sarge said he always caught big channel cats. For bait, they had a can of Spam. That and a couple of poles, and they were in business. Sarge asked Don if he wanted to come, but to his surprise, he didn't. After all that bitching about being stuck in the cabin for so long, and he turns down a chance to get out? Figures, Sarge thought. Sarge told Doc to keep an eye on him, and he and Ted headed up the creek for a little fishing. They anchored inside the creek, keeping close to the bank to try to provide as much cover as possible. The two of them sat and fished for a while, and the fishing was pretty good. In fewer than 2 hours, they had 8 nice cats in the live well. Sarge decided they had enough, and they headed back for the cabin. As they pulled up to the shack, Sarge was pissed not to see Doc.
"Where the hell is he?"
Sarge growled, as Ted tied up the boat. He went to the door and threw it open. Doc was kneeling down on the floor, and Mike was beside him.
"What the fuck is going on in here?" Sarge barked.
When Doc looked back, Sarge could see they were leaning over Don, who was sprawled on the floor. The little shack had a strange smell, something antiseptic.
"He found that shine we took off the pirates. He drank 2 pints of it straight down," Doc said.
"Holy shit! I forgot all about that shit. Where was it?"
Sarge said. Mike looked up, his bandaged jaw preventing him from speaking, and pointed to the shelf under the little kitchen sink. Chapter 14. The next morning I got up and had breakfast with the girls. This was going to be their first encounter with fried mush, and I was extremely interested to see how they would take it. I was in the kitchen when they came in, and the smell of bacon filled the room. Mel was still asleep. This would be your introduction to the dish as well. Last night, before going to bed, I had taken a few minutes to boil up some cornmeal, the first step in making fried mush, and put it in the fridge before going to bed. There was a 12-inch cast-iron skillet on the old butterfly stove, and I had dropped 2 big spoonfuls of bacon grease into it. Cutting slices of the boiled cornmeal, about a half-inch thick, I laid them into the grease, and they landed with a satisfying sizzle. I lightly browned both sides and then took them from the grease and put them on a paper plate. Glad I had stocked up on those. Leanne and Taylor came in. Taylor loves bacon, and I knew the smell of it drifting through the house would get her out of bed. As she came into the kitchen, she said, "Mmm, bacon." "Not quite, but just as good," I replied. Leanne walked over and looked at the plate. "What is that?" she asked in her best disgusted teenager voice. "It's fried mush," I said with a shitty grin on my face. "There is no way I'm eating that," Leanne said. I knew that was coming and probably shouldn't have told her what it was called. I took a piece from the paper plate and put it on another, then drizzled honey over it. "Here, just try it," I said, handing her the plate. She took the plate and eyed it suspiciously, looked at Taylor, and said, "You try it," and handed her the plate. Taylor took the plate and smelled it. "Smells like bacon," she said, then picked up a fork and cut a corner off and stuffed it in her mouth. A huge grin spread across her face. "Tastes like soap," she said, which is a running joke in our house for something that is good. Leanne had a look on her face that said she didn't buy it, but took the next plate I prepared. Then I made one for myself and started to eat. She finally took a bite.
"Hey, that's pretty good. What is it?"
I told them what it was, and we all had a second piece. By now, we were making enough noise that Little Bit came out, rubbing her eyes and dragging Bobby Jack, her stuffed monkey, behind her. Bobby Jack was a constant fixture with her. It was one of those stuffed animals you go to the mall for. Go in the store, pick out a carcass, and then they stuff a tube up its ass and pump it full of polyester foam. I guessed if kids ever really thought about that process, the bear shop would have gone out of business. I felt a sudden pang for the stupid stuffed animal shop, the world that had supported something so far removed from keeping your family safe and feeding them was gone. And for all its flaws, I missed it. She came over to the island and climbed up onto a stool.
"What's that?"
she asked, looking at the plate.
Before I could say anything, her sister shouted, "It's mush!" Anything they could do to try and torment her. She gave them both a look, then asked, "Is it good?" The girls finished off what was left on the plate. Fortunately, I had put two slabs aside for Mel, and I went into our room to see if she was awake. "You up?" From under the covers came a muffled reply. "It's cold. Did you start a fire yet?" "Yeah, the girls are sitting in front of it now. I made breakfast and the coffee's ready," I replied. As she pulled the covers off her head, she asked, "When are you going to get that stove set up in here?" This was on her constant nag list. I had the wood stove, but had never gotten around to putting it in our room. I guessed I was going to have to break down and do it. "As soon as I get some time, I have to help Danny get some water going at his place, and I have to take some stuff to an old lady at the end of the road who's having a hard time. Maybe tomorrow, if nothing goes to hell today," I told her. "What are you taking, and who is it for?" "The old lady that has the 40 acres down past Danny and Bobby. She's been eating cat food, so I'm taking her some of the venison from last night's deer and some other stuff."
"Miss Janice? She's been eating cat food?"
Mel had a look of disgust on her face. "Yeah, can't imagine it either," I said. "Don't give away too much. We have three girls to take care of." "Yeah, I had that talk with Mark last night." A chorus of, "Danny's here!" from the living room let me know that he was here to help pull the pump. I walked into the living room as he came in with a, "Yo," his standard greeting. Little Bit jumped on him, and he picked her up and played with the monkey for a minute, then set her down. "You ready?" he asked. "I was just heading out. Let's get this thing broke apart and see what we can do at your place," I said. We went outside the sliding glass door into the backyard.
"What the fuck, man? You kill another one?"
Danny said when he saw the skinned deer hanging from the tree in front of the shop. "Yeah. Meathead jumped it last night, and I dropped it. I wasn't looking to, but it was running right at me. Let's cut a quarter off for you guys when we're done." Danny just shook his head. "People are going to hate you."
"Let them hate. We're taking a quarter to Miss Janice down the road from you, too. We'll have to bone that one out and cut it up for her, though," I said.
"She out of food?"
"Been eating cat food," I said.
"Shit," was all he said. It took us about 15 minutes to pull the pump. When I installed it, I had used unions for both connects to make replacing it easier. I carried the pump out to the Suburban, and when I came back around the house, Danny was already cutting the deer up.
"Thank God it's winter. I don't know what we're going to do in the summer. Damn sure won't be able to hang him like this," he said. We worked together to cut a quarter off for him. Then we cut a front shoulder off and carried it over to the cleaning table. Working together, we cut all the meat from the bones and put it in the freezer bags, making sure to cut all the pieces small. When that was done, we wrapped Danny's hindquarters in some butcher paper and loaded it in the truck with the freezer bags. Danny headed out on his Polaris, and I drove the Suburban. On the way down to his house, Mark came out of his drive in the mule. Danny stopped in the road. I stopped behind him and walked up to Mark. He and Danny were shaking hands when I walked up.
"Hey, Mark. You heard anything about the old man?" I asked.
"Morning, Mark. He's still at the doc's house. He's keeping him there. Doc said the wound is healing, but he's still worried about infection."
"How much of the leg did he lose?" Danny asked.
"Doc managed to save it just below the knee. He still has the joint. Not that it'll do him much good. I think the prosthetics industry is probably closed now. He did say that tourniquet you put on saved his life."
"Well, that's good. I just couldn't stand there and let him bleed to death," I replied, feeling a little awkward. "Think anyone will remember that?"
"Good luck," Danny said.
"I don't know," Mark added. "Can't hurt, I guess."
We stood there for a minute, talking over some of the news, which consisted of food, water, and the weather, as well as firewood, which was talked about almost as often as the others.
"Where are you guys headed?" Mark asked.
"Down to Miss Janice's place. We have some food for her, and I want to take a look around her fence," I said,
Let me know what you find. I'm curious if she really saw something, or if she's having hallucinations, Mark said.
Anita carried clean clothes out to Thad while he washed in a bucket set under the old pitcher pump outside. The water was cold as hell, but his wife had made it plainly clear he wasn't coming back into her house till he took a bath. He actually needed a bath, so it wasn't a bad thing. He thought of what she had said, my house. He smiled to himself and shook his head, thinking about how fast a woman takes possession of something, be it a house or a man. After dressing, he went back inside, where it was warm. Anita had lunch ready, beans and rice today. He couldn't complain. Every day his family got fed was a good day. He didn't know what she did to make it taste so good, but he enjoyed it. Little Tony, however, was not a fan. But he had been raised not to question what was put on his plate, and he ate it. When they were done, the little boy cleared the table, and Anita started on the dishes. She had to carry water in from the pump in a bucket and pour it in the sink. All the washing was done with cold water. That was the one thing that Anita complained about. Thad went out and drove the truck around to the barn. He was going to take the radio out to make it more portable in the event they had to bug out and didn't get the truck. This way, he could put it in the scout if he needed to. Thad was sitting on the ground, cutting wires under the dash, when the little man came outside.
Daddy, Mama wants you.
What's she need, little man? Thad asked.
Somebody's here.
Thad jumped to his feet and headed for the back door. He came into the kitchen and didn't see Anita and headed for the living room. Anita was at the front door, standing behind it, with it only partially open. She heard him coming and looked back. Thad stepped past her and pulled the door open. Standing there was the mailman again, with that same shitty-ass grin on his face.
Thaddeus Jones, the mailman said as the door flew open.
What do you want? Thad demanded.
Well, I told you that I'd be back with instructions for you, and here I am.
Thad started to tell the guy to go to hell, but thought better of it. Instead, he reached out and took the envelope that the man was holding out. Opening the envelope, Thad pulled out a folded-over form typical of all government forms, full of all kinds of information, except what you want to see. After scanning it for a minute, he finally saw what he was looking for. In a box labeled Unit Assignment, he saw the name Avon 4. From his travels across Florida, he assumed this meant Avon Park. Looking the document over further, he saw another box labeled Assigned Discipline. Inside this box were three words, Driver, Manual Laborer. He knew exactly what that meant. He might be driving a truck, but more likely he'd be digging ditches somewhere. Folding the paper back up, he unfolded the second piece, the one with Anita's name on it. Thad took a quick look and saw that her unit assignment was Avon 2.
Why does she have a different unit assignment than me? Thad asked.
I cannot answer any questions. I'm just here to drop off the information. As you can see, you have a departure date here.
The mailman reached over the top of the paper and tapped a section of the form. It was 2 days away.
And what are we supposed to do?
Raising his clipboard again and going through the sheaf of papers, the mailman said, It says here you are to depart from Lutz. Thad looked at the man.
And how in the hell are we supposed to get to Lutz? You know how far that is?
You have 2 days. It's just down 41. Should be an easy walk.
Anything else? Thad asked.
Yes. Don't miss your bus. You will be bused to your final destination, and you do not want them to come looking for you.
As the mailman spoke, he pointed to the security man he had with him. He was the same as the last time. Black uniform with a big DHS patch on the sleeve.
Oh, you won't have to come get us, I promise, Thad replied, and shut the door.
Thad stood and looked through the little fan-shaped window at the top of the door as the mailman walked back to his jeep. Leaning on the hood, he looked back at the house while he spoke to the security man. He reached into his shirt pocket
and took out a pack of smokes, pulled one out with his teeth, then produced a lighter and lit it. He tossed the pack and lighter on the hood, and the security man picked them up and lit himself one. They stood there, leaning on the white Jeep, smoking their cigarettes. Thad watched them through the little window, wondering if this was something they did to get a rise out of people who had been through forced withdrawal from nicotine. "I don't smoke, assholes," Thad thought, as they stood there. It didn't take them long to finish their smokes. They flipped the butts into the yard. Not the edge of the yard, but out into it. Eventually, they climbed into the Jeep and drove off. Thad stood there for a while, looking at the road. The Jeep was gone, and he didn't see anything that worried him. After a moment, he heard Anita behind him and turned to her. "We gotta go." "Where?" she asked. And again, that look of fear was on her face. It hurt worse than anything he had ever felt in his life. Just knowing she was afraid made Thad mad. He was supposed to take care of her, protect her. That was a man's job, after all. "I don't know, but we have to leave from here." Anita sat down on the old sofa in the living room. "When?" Thad stood there for a minute and thought about it, then looked at her. She looked so small to him, and he went over and sat beside her. "Tomorrow night. We'll wait till it gets dark, then we'll leave." Thad reached out and wrapped his arms around her. She leaned into him and almost disappeared into his huge shoulders. Little Tony came in the room and looked at his mother. He could tell she was scared, and that scared him. He walked over and sat on one of her knees and looked up at his dad. Thad looked down at the boy and smiled. It was a forced smile, but he wanted to make him feel a little better.
"What's wrong, Mama?"
Tony asked. Anita reached out and put a hand on his head.
"Nothing, baby. I'm okay."
"You look sad."
Anita stood up and looked at Thad.
"Well, I guess we got work to do if we're leaving tomorrow."
"Where are we going?"
little Tony asked. She looked back to the boy with a smile in her face, one that didn't look as forced as Thad's.
"On a trip. You want to go for a ride in the truck?"
"Yeah!"
Thad had already pre-positioned most of what they thought they would need, but they made another pass through the house, looking for things they could use. Thad piled the few items they came up with on the back porch, along with some assorted tools that he grabbed out of the shop. Now he just had to get everything loaded into the Scout. The Scout was in the woods, about a mile away. The cache was buried in the woods, out behind the house, and they had things there they needed to take with them as well. Thad sat on the swing on the back porch, thinking about it. The most logical thing to do was to get the Scout and drive it around and load everything up. But he was nervous to do it, afraid that someone would be watching, and the moment he tried to move anything, they would swoop in. More important than when and how to go and get his supplies was where he was going to go. Thad sat there rocking in the swing, going over the options in his head. He wished he could get back to Sarge, but he hadn't talked to him in some time. Then he thought about Morgan, but the thought of just dropping in on someone unannounced was a bad idea. He needed to get on the radio and see if he could reach anyone, maybe get some ideas from the guys. Thad went back in the house and told Anita he needed to go for a walk to use the radio and try to get a hold of someone to see what they should do. The radio was still lying in the front seat of the old truck, where he had left it, when he was interrupted while removing it. Picking it and the antenna up, Thad started out through the back of the property toward where the cache was buried. He didn't want to walk down the road, and he had to put the trail in from there to the Scout, so he figured it would be the safest route to get to it. Crossing the fence, he picked the trail and headed for the old truck. After stringing the antenna in the tallest tree he could find, he opened the hood and connected the power cable directly to the battery using his Leatherman tool. Taking out his notebook from Sarge, he started going through the frequencies, listening for any transmissions. He heard a lot of talk, just not from the people he wanted to talk to. Some of the chatter caught his attention, and he stopped on a frequency to listen. A man from Jacksonville was on the radio. An old man from the sound of his voice. He was going on and on about what he called the Hessians. He told of how a group of armed men were going around the city, killing, robbing, raping, basically doing whatever they wanted. He claimed they had working vehicles, motorcycles, and ATVs, and were running rampant. When he paused, another voice came over the station, talking of the same thing. He was in Atlanta, and said that groups like that were also there. They ran through parts of town where there was no federal presence, which had been growing by the day. The two men talked, and Thad listened as they exchanged stories of how these groups would show up when the people of the area refused to cooperate with the FEMA plan, and how they thought it was the government doing it. When the group showed up, they stayed to a fairly defined area, raising general hell. After several days of this, the FEMA DHS troops would move in and the thugs would move out. The man in Atlanta claimed he witnessed what he called a mock firefight, the two groups confronting each other in the open streets. He said there was lots of gunfire, but no casualties on either side. As the federal troops moved in, the thugs would gradually pull back and out of the area, and were not pursued. The two of them were in agreement that these were government-sanctioned thugs sent in to intimidate the local populace into submitting to the federal authority. Thad listened to this for a while, then moved on to other frequencies. As he scanned the bands, that name stuck in his head. Hessians. He thought about that, trying to remember where he had heard it. Then it came to him. German mercenaries were used by the British during the Revolutionary War. He was rolling that thought around in his head when he heard a pop, or thought he did. Looking up from the radio, he surveyed the area around him. Nothing was moving, no sound. Then he heard it again. One pop. This time he knew what it was, and took off at a run toward the house. Chapter 15.
He's going into arrest. I'm going to start CPR, Doc said.
Sarge stepped over and put a hand on Doc's shoulder.
No, you're not. Don't waste your energy on him.
Doc looked up at Sarge, and the look on his face told the old man he was pissed.
Look, son, he's gone. And even if you bring him back, then what?
Doc looked back down at the rotund man on the floor and dropped his hands onto his BDU-clad thighs. He sat there shaking his head.
I guess you're right. It's probably what he was trying to do.
Sarge made Mike go lie back down while he, Ted, and Doc dragged Don's body out of the shack. Out on the deck, Doc asked Sarge what he was going to do with the body. Sarge told him that tonight they would take him downriver in the boat and drop him in. When Doc tried to protest, saying that was where people, including them, were getting their drinking water, Sarge reminded him of how many gator and fish carcasses had probably been thrown into that river in the last several weeks. The three of them got the body into one of the boats and covered with a tarp. Sarge wanted to wait until it was pretty late to go out on the river, so there was time to kill. Going back inside, he sat down at the radios again and played around with the bands. With his headset on, he looked over to one of the other radios that was tuned to a preset band and connected to a laptop. A program was running on it, and there was a map of the southeast. He looked at the screen for a minute, then turned back to the big box in front of him. Ted stayed outside to keep watch while Doc tended to Mike. His wound looked good. Doc changed the dressing every day, but that was putting a dent in his supply of bandages. While applying a Telfa pad to Mike's jaw, he thought they would need to find a source for more. The typical places ran through his head. Pharmacies, hospitals, and the like. Pharmacies would surely be looted out, and hospitals would be too damn dangerous to even think about. But it didn't change the fact that they were going to need more. Mike was conscious, and getting a little restless. Doc told him he needed to take it easy, but Mike told him he needed to get up for a bit, or he was going to lose his mind. Doc finally relented, and Mike got up and went to the kitchen. He was hungry and wanted something to eat. The bullet had passed along his jaw, but the wound was only in the soft tissue. He knew it would be painful to eat, but he was damn hungry.
He started some soup and sat at the table with Sarge. Sarge was going through the bands and stopped on one. He unplugged the headset, and the speaker squawked to life. Mike and Doc both looked up at the same time as the sound of a man's voice filled the room. Even Ted opened the door and stuck his head in at the sudden sound. They all stood there listening as a voice filled with panic came out of the speaker. The man was screaming into the radio about gangs rampaging through town, how the feds were just outside of town and weren't doing anything about it. He had tried to leave, to get away from the chaos, but was turned back by armed men in black uniforms with DHS patches on their shoulders. He said he had begged them to let him and his family out, told them what was going on in town, but they wouldn't let them leave. There were many people there trying to get out, but none of them were let through. Women were begging DHS to at least let the children through, but all were turned away. Now he was back in his house, trying to hide from the terror in the streets. They could hear gunfire. It was not very loud or frequent at first, but the tempo and volume increased along with the panic in the man's voice. It wasn't long before they heard screams intermixed with the gunfire. Ted had opened the door, and all four of them were standing there, listening, as the scene unfolded in their minds. By then, the man was shrieking into the radio. A crash came out of the speaker, then screams, closer screams, and other voices. These voices were angry, hate-filled, and loud. A woman screeched in the background, then another female did too, and that one sounded much, much younger. The man was still yelling when the station cleared and silence filled the shack. The four of them stood there, not wanting to look at one another. Mike stood up and walked over to the little stove and turned off the burner, then went back to the table and sat down, suddenly no longer hungry. Later, Ted was on the radios, listening for anything that might be out there. The military radios were all silent, but the ham had plenty of traffic on it. As Ted listened, he heard people from all over the country talking, and then he caught a transmission that grabbed him. A ham in England was talking with another in Maine. According to the English ham operator, while there had been some damage in the UK associated to the solar flare, power lines down, substations burned out, and many structures burned as a result of the power lines overloading and setting them on fire. There was no damage to cars, and most electronics still worked in the areas that had power. Power was out in most of the country, but there were small pockets that had it, and the other areas were being restored. The citizens of England had been told that restoring power to the entire country would be a slow process, as the large transformers used at power plants and substations would take time to manufacture. There were even cases of transformers sitting in storage yards, catching fire and burning. It had been determined that the stored units had not been properly grounded and had absorbed the load from the flare, causing the damage. Ted listened for a few more minutes, then went out to let Sarge know what he had heard. He sat on an old wire reel and relayed the information to the old man. Sarge sat there listening, taking it all in, not saying anything. Ted finished with, "What you think?" Sarge sat there for a minute and then said, "I guess that proves my theory." "What theory is that?" "Remember when I said that an EMP could have been set off, either as an act of terrorism or deliberately by our own government?" Ted thought about it for a minute. "Vaguely. You think that could be it?" "What the hell else would do all this? Sure, some of it may have been from the flare, but the rest of this had to be something else."
"Who do you think did it?"
Sarge rocked his chair back on its rear legs.
"Doesn't really matter, does it?"
"I guess not.
Go tell Doc that we're going to go drop Dawn off."
When they had found a likely place in the river and lifted Dawn to drop him over the side, Ted said,
"Kinda messed up just dropping him in the river."
"Best we can do for him," Sarge said.
He went back to the console and turned the boat back down the river. "Let's go drop off the food before we start in the pump. If she really is out of food, then I want to get it to her quick," I said, as Danny climbed onto the Polaris.
"Cool. Let's go by the house and drop mine off. I'll ride with you."
I nodded my head as he started the machine. I followed him down to his place and waited at the gate while he drove it up to the shop and parked it. Danny walked back out to the gate and climbed in, and we headed down toward Miss Janice's house. She had 40 acres at the end of the street, which turned into her driveway. Her gate was closed, and Danny got out and opened it. I drove through, and he closed it behind me. Pulling up in front of her house, I honked the horn as we got out. Danny went toward the house, and I went around to the back of the truck to get the food out. I could see the old woman talking to him at the front door as I walked up with what we brought. She looked frail and sickly, but she was very warm and welcoming.
"Come in, come in," she said
as I came up, holding the door for the two of us. We went in, and the old woman was upset she didn't have anything to offer us except hot water with a little lemon juice. "Don't worry about us. We're here to bring you some stuff," I said. I set the bag of venison on her little kitchen table, then a cloth shopping bag with a couple pounds of lentils, 5 pounds of rice, a couple dozen tea bags, a Ziploc bag of sugar, some assorted cans of veggies, and 2 cans of Spam. When I looked up at her, she had tears in her eyes. Her thin hands were pressed together in front of her mouth and were shaking.
"You okay?" I asked.
She stepped over and reached out and wrapped her arms around me. Patting her on the back, I tried to comfort her.
"It's okay.
Mark said you might need some help, so we came down. I just wish we had known earlier." Through her tears, she thanked us, hugging Danny as well, and told us how desperate she had been. How she couldn't bear the thought of asking anyone for anything when no one had anything to give. She didn't know what she was going to do, and had prayed to God. Then, there we were, and she knew it was an answer to her prayers. I told her I didn't know about an answer to her prayers, but it would help for a while. I told her that it was very important that she not tell anyone. She didn't understand why I wouldn't want anyone to know. She had heard bad things about me from some of the people in the neighborhood. But what she had been told couldn't be right.
"You can't be as bad as they say. Here you are bringing me all this."
I told her I appreciated the vote of confidence and let her know she was in the minority for thinking that way. Looking around her place, I saw a big fireplace in the living room. It was an older style one that had a big black iron hook on one side for suspending a pot over the fire. That answered my question about where she was going to cook. We finally got around to asking her about the men she had seen on her property. She told us she had seen 2 men on the other side of the pasture. They were standing on the outside of the fence, looking at her house. When I asked if they had guns, she just laughed.
"Sweetheart, these old eyes can't see that far."
She couldn't tell how they were dressed either. When I asked if she was sure she saw people, she replied,
"Unless Bigfoot is wandering around out there, they walk down the fence yonder,"
and pointed across the field. Danny told her to take care of herself, and that if she needed anything, to drop by his house. He then asked if she had a gun.
"Hang on,"
she said, and walked out of the room. She returned with a 1903 Springfield. It looked kind of comical. Before us stood this little old woman, not more than 5'2", her frail hands wrapped around the stock of a big old rifle held up at her waist. It was something out of an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies. "Granny's going out possum hunting." Danny was shaking his head. "You know how to use that thing?" The old woman smiled, opened the bolt, and closed it with a slap.
"You betcha."
I couldn't help but laugh. "You be careful with that artillery. We're going to go and take a look at the fence." We finally get out of her house after several rounds of thank yous and goodbyes. We went to the suburban first to get our rifles, then headed out across the field. We were both laughing about the 03, how big it looked in her hands, and what we thought would happen if she pulled the trigger. Once we got to the fence, Danny went right and I went left. We were going to walk the length of it to see if we saw anything. I was almost to the north end of the fence line when Danny called out, "Over here!" Walking back down the fence, I saw what he was looking at. On the other side of the fence were several sets of footprints. The prints went off into the bush on the other side of the fence. "I'm gonna hop over and see where they go," Danny said.
I'll come with you, I said. We need to be careful, though.
The tracks went down a little trail that intersected with a larger one, where there were tracks from an ATV. It looked like there were two people that came in on it. Worse was that it looked like they had been there more than once. The trail went off into the Ocala National Forest. They could have come from anywhere. We talked about the possibilities for a minute, then about how long since they had been there. The tracks were not fresh. It looked as though it had been several days at least. Danny had the idea to sweep the trail. If anyone came again, the tracks would be clear, and if they came in and saw the trail swept, then they would know someone knew they had been there. We cut some scrub oaks and took a few minutes to wipe out the tracks for about 20 feet of the trail. We'd done everything we could for the moment and headed back to the truck to go and get the pump installed at Danny's. The pump installation didn't take long, but if it weren't for the huge pile of PVC parts Danny had, it wouldn't have been possible. Danny liked yard sales and always looked for those boxes or buckets full of miscellaneous parts that seemed to be at every yard sale. He had piles of assorted stuff. PVC parts were just part of that inventory. Initially, we are just going to connect a hose bib to the discharge side so we could fill a drum every few days, but I had another idea. Using the wires that were already there, I spliced them into the cord of the pump. I went to his panel and moved those wires to a single pole breaker in his panel on the same phase as the inverter. Wired like this, the pressure switch for the pump would control this pump as well. When the pressure dropped, the pump would kick on and pressurize the tank, then cut off. It would function just like the in-well pump. Bobby was positively thrilled when she realized she could use the toilets again.
Chapter 16. As Thad ran back down the trail toward the fence, he heard automatic weapons fire, then nothing, save himself crashing through the brush. His mind was racing, his heart was pounding, and he was scared shitless. He gripped the old side-by-side in his right hand, and all he could think was, "Let me just get there. Let me just get there." He let out a cry as black smoke started to rise into the sky. As he got closer to the fence, he caught glimpses of the flames through the trees. He didn't know it, but he had started to cry. Reaching the fence, he could now see the nightmarish scene in full. Flames leapt from the roof of the house, and thick black smoke was pouring out the kitchen door. Thad put a palm on a fence post and vaulted the fence. Without thinking about his own safety, he ran toward the house. Smoke poured from the open front door. He stopped there for a second, looking at his worst nightmare unfolding before him. He took a quick look up the road, just as a white male Jeep turned off the road. Thad put his forearm over his mouth and ran through the front door, but it was futile. The smoke was so thick it burned his eyes. They teared up immediately to the point he couldn't see. He dropped to the floor and tried to crawl in, but the thick smoke was now less than a foot from the floor. He crawled out the front door, coughing and gagging. Once outside, he fell on the ground, still gagging. Finally catching a breath, he stood up, screaming for Anita and Tony, but there was no reply. Kneeling down, he stuck his arm in the front door and groped around beside it. He felt a pack and pulled it out. His. Sticking his arm back in, he felt for the others, and his heart sank when he found them and pulled them out. He sat there holding little Tony's pack, crushing it against his chest and wailing. He was crying so hard he was convulsing. Reaching out, he pulled Anita's pack over and cradled it in his arms. Looking into the hellfire behind the door, he again screamed for Anita, and again, there was no reply. Thad got to his feet and remembered the SKS in the wall. Reaching around the corner, he grabbed the hook and yanked the panel off, then knelt down and felt for the rifle. Finding it and the other stuff he'd put in there, he took it all out. He chambered around in the SKS. The fire was growing in intensity, and he had to back away from the house. He carried the three packs over to the truck and dropped them in the bed. Lowering the tailgate, he sat down. All he could do was wait for the flames to die down. Thad sat there as the fire consumed the house, its progress marked by small pops, windows falling out,
the roof falling in, and then the walls collapsing. Thad sat and watched, feeling completely and utterly impotent. He pushed away the thought that his wife and little boy were in the house to a deep part of his brain. He sat in the bed of the truck and cried throughout the night. The fire burned itself out in the early morning. The thoughts of Anita and Tony were clawing to get out, but he succeeded in pushing them back in the hole in his chest. He tried to look around in the ruins of the house, but it was still hot and too dark. It would be several more hours before the sun came up, several more hours to keep those thoughts shut up. When Thad opened his eyes, the sky was just starting to lighten. It was overcast, and the layer of clouds looked like slate. He knew he needed to go into the house, but he didn't want to. He stood there for a moment, surveying the scene before him. Rubbing his chin, he stepped up to where the door once was and looked again. Inside the angular blackness was what one would expect to find after a house burned. The springs from the living room furniture and the beds. There was a pile of pots and pans, the cabinets having turned to vapor around them. In the center of the black was the bowl from the toilet, the tank lying in shards around it. His eyes settled on a form in front of the springs of the sofa. A rather large charred lump with soft curves was covered with ash and charcoal. He wasn't consciously observing it, but his eyes were fixed on it. It was the lines of pink and white that brought him around. In all the black, there were cracks of pink and white under the char. Thad slowly walked through the ash and debris, stopping just short of the form. As he stepped around it, and turning his head, the form slowly took on a recognizable shape. In an almost detached manner, he made out a head, then an arm. Under the arm was another head, though smaller. Though he was looking at the charred remains of his family, that wasn't what he saw. He saw Anita lying on the floor holding Tony. That was how he would always remember them. Not this. This wasn't them. Turning away from them, he went out to the barn, which hadn't burned, and found a shovel. Going out to where he had buried the old man, Thad started to dig. The digging lasted into the midday. Thad dug without stopping. When the first grave was complete, he stepped out and shoved the spade into the ground to start the second. With the spade buried in the ground and his foot still on it, he paused, looking into the hole. Pulling the blade out of the ground, he stepped back into the hole and started to cut the side out, enlarging it. Widening the hole didn't take long. With the digging complete, he stepped back out of the now larger hole, walked over to the old pump, and took a long drink. Walking back out to the front of the house, Thad reached into the bed and took out the two smaller packs. Setting them on the tailgate, he opened them and pulled out some items of each. From Tony's pack, he took a transformer. He held it and looked at it. After a moment, he opened his pack and stuck the toy inside. In Anita's pack, he found her hairbrush. It was an old heirloom she had for as long as Thad had known her. The silver was tarnished and the bristles worn, but she treasured it. And now he would. Holding it to his face, he breathed deeply, taking in her scent with his eyes closed. Letting out the breath, he stuffed the brush into his pack as well. He took the two ponchos from their packs and went back into the scorched remains of the house. Unrolling the ponchos on a fairly flat spot, he steeled his nerves for what came next. He was standing there, flexing his fingers, tense, anxious, and nervous. Looking down at his hands, it suddenly struck him that he could not do this barehanded. The thought of having them on his hands was too much. Thad went back out to the truck and pulled the old work gloves from his pack and returned to them. With the gloves on, he knelt to the task at hand. It was gruesome, grisly work. For the first time since the sun had risen, the tears returned to his eyes. Getting them both out and wrapped, Thad went back to the barn and returned with a wheelbarrow. They were so small he was able to move them both at the same time. He gently placed them in the grave, still wrapped up. Looking at the two bundles, it didn't feel right. As gently as he could, Thad unwrapped them, leaving one poncho underneath them both. He placed Tony's little form back into his mother's arms, then covered them both, the second poncho. He stood and looked down at them, the tears running down his nose, small round spots shining in the poncho where the tears landed. Thad reached up and pulled the watch cap from his head and ran his hand over his stubble. He looked at the cap, then back at the poncho. Leaning down, he lifted the poncho and placed the cap between the two of them. That little act made a difference to him. He suddenly felt better. He had them to keep with him, and now they had him for eternity. Thad filled the grave slowly. He worked steadily, and the grave was full too soon. He decided against a marker. If he marked the grave, then others would be able to find it, and he would prefer that no one ever know where they lay. Realizing there was nothing more he could do, Thad looked down at the fresh dirt. The mound barely rose above the surrounding grade. He said, "I love you, and I always will. I will see you again, and until that time, I will carry you in my heart." With that, he went back out to the front of the house and began putting his gear together. He was going to go get the scout and all the stuff he had in the cache. He knew what he needed to do and where to start. How wasn't important. Getting it done was. He'd move the scout closer to where he would need it. With what he had in mind, the old pickup would be useless shortly. Thad knew the post office was on 45 and Land O'Lakes, and that was where he was going to start looking for that son of a bitch. The problem was going to be getting there. He couldn't just drive the truck into town. That was guaranteed to get him snagged. He had to find another way to get there. At his old house, he had a mountain bike. He, Anita, and Tony used to go for rides together, but that was not something he could think about right now. Parking the scout at the burned house, he took the truck and went over to get the bike. Pulling up in front of his house, the house where he had lived for so long with his wife and son, he almost couldn't get out of the truck. There was no way he could go inside, so he walked around the house to the barn out back. The bikes were leaned against one wall, covered in a tarp. Thad pulled the tarp off and dropped it to the ground. He stood there for a minute, looking at the three bikes leaning against the old boards of the barn. He remembered the day he had put the basket on the front of Anita's bike, and the day he had taken the training wheels off Tony's. He was starting to well up thinking about them, but he pushed it back down, grabbed his bike, and returned to the truck. He tossed the bike into the bed of the truck, and headed back to where the scout was parked. Having seen the way the mail truck turned when it left the house, Thad knew which way it had to be going to get to the post office, if that's where it had gone. The opposite end of Swift Mud Road dead-ended into Pump Station Road. It was a county road, and was usually blocked by gates at either end. But it was the most direct route into town. They must have opened it up for their use, Thad figured. If they were using that road, that was where he was going to get him. Thad drove past the road to the burned house and headed toward Pump Station Road, and just as he had thought, the gate on that end was open. About halfway down the road was the pump station, and just before he came to it, Thad turned off the paved road onto a dirt road off to the right. He drove the truck down the little dirt road until he was a pretty good distance into the swamp, then pulled off the road and concealed the truck in the swamp. He cut limbs and palm fronds to hide the truck. Once that was done, he got on the bike and headed back to where the scout was parked. Riding the bike was another trigger for the memories to surface. They had ridden on this very road many times before. It had been a safe place for Tony to ride, as there wasn't any traffic on it. Again, he pushed those memories back into that deep, dark place, the pit that was getting bigger every hour. He was back at the scout in just a little more than a half hour. Once there, he loaded the bike on the roof of the old truck and headed back to where he had hidden the pickup. He hid the scout farther down the dirt road and on the other side. Since it was four-wheel drive, he was able to drive it farther out into the swamp before concealing it. Thad got on the bike and headed for town. He wanted to see if the mail truck was at the post office. He took his pack and pistol with him. In the pack, he had some MREs and two canteens of water.
Sarge and Ted made it back to the cabin without seeing another person. Ted was securing a line to a cleat on the little dock when Sarge jumped off and started down the little boardwalk. Ted met him on his way back. He was carrying his M1A and a pack.
"Where are you going?" Ted asked.
"Hunting," Sarge replied, as he jumped into the boat.
"Keep an eye on things here. I'll be back later."
"You gonna keep an eye on Don and see who shows up?"
"Yep."
Sarge backed the boat down the creek and motored down toward its mouth. He nosed the boat into the back behind a couple of cypress trees and tied it off. He found a suitable hide under a couple of downed trees not far away. Climbing under them, he started to make the hide comfortable for his stay. He cut some limbs out of his way and put down the foam mat. Once he had his hide ready, he took the suppressor from the pack and screwed it on the M1A. Laying the pack in front of him, he laid the rifle across it and put some camo cream on his face. Once he had his face painted up, he got comfortable and waited. He had his thermos of coffee with him, and he passed the time sipping on it. Using his NVGs, he scanned the river from time to time, but didn't see anything. As dawn approached and the sky began to lighten, he began to hear boats on the river, and saw them soon after. Mostly canoes and rowboats. It was one of those canoes that spotted the body floating in the river. There were three people in the canoe, and they carried on a conversation amongst themselves. Eventually, the person in the middle held on to Don's shirt, and the other two paddled the canoe to the other side of the river and pushed the body against some snags to keep it in place. The spot where they hung the body was at Sarge's 2 o'clock and about 300 yards away. Now that he had a target distance, Sarge made a couple of adjustments to his scope and settled down again. The canoe started down the river and soon disappeared from Sarge's line of sight. Now it was a waiting game. Sarge was screwing the cup back on the thermos when he first heard the sound of someone in the swamp behind him. Now he wished he had brought his carbine with him. Drawing his .45, he rolled over so he could look behind him and waited. After a moment, a low whistle came out of the swamp. Sarge shook his head and whistled back. In a moment, Mike's face appeared under the logs. He had a big, goofy smile on his face. All the more goofy because of the wound to his jaw. Sarge was shaking his head.
"What the fuck are you doing here?"
"I had to get out of there. I'm going stir crazy."
"Well, get your ass in here before someone sees you."
Mike wiggled his way into the hide, elbowing Sarge in the ribs in the process. Sarge rolled onto his side, put a boot against Mike's hip, and shoved him over, both of them cussing. Adding Mike to the small hide was bad enough, but he also had brought the saw with him, and they had to make room for that as well. Mike took a few minutes to cut away some limbs to give him an unobstructed field of fire. Eventually, they were both settled into the little hide, and they got as comfortable as they could. They lay there talking in low whispers. Sarge asked how his jaw was, and Mike told him it was getting better. Doc was pretty anal about the dressings being changed, and made sure he took the antibiotics. After an hour, Mike elbowed Sarge and nodded his head downriver. Sarge looked up to see a boat coming slowly upriver from the direction of Suwanee. Lowering his head to the scope, he looked at the boat. There were two men in black uniforms, and while he couldn't read the patches on their shoulders, he could see enough to know they were DHS patches. There were also two other people on the boat in civilian clothes, and one of them, for sure, was from the canoe. Without lifting his head, he told Mike to keep an eye on the river for any other boats. The boat eased up to the body at the direction of the civilians. While one of the DHS goons controlled the boat, the other three men leaned over the side of the boat to where the body was snagged on the logs. As the three men were trying to pull the body back into the boat, Sarge settled the crosshairs on the side of the boat driver's head. As the body was clearing the gunwale, Sarge let out a slow breath and squeezed the trigger. The driver fell into the boat, and the other looked back. Sarge already had the crosshairs lined up on the second uniform figure, and when he turned to look back, Sarge squeezed the trigger again. The black-clad figure fell over the side,
taking Don's body with it. The two civilians ducked down. Sarge watched them as they crawled around. A bloody hand reached up and pulled the boat into reverse, then took a hold of the steering wheel and started backing it out into the river. Once the boat was out in the channel, one of the civilians stood up and opened the throttle and headed downriver. As soon as the boat was out of sight, Mike and Sarge immediately started to clean out the hide. They took everything with them, leaving as little trace as they could. Chapter 17. I left Danny and Bobby to once again marvel at the miracle that is indoor plumbing. Mark was out in the yard at his shed when I went by, so I pulled up to his gate and let myself in. He was going through the boxes we had gotten from the county, labeled humanitarian aid. He had several of them laid out in front of the little shed. "What you doing?" I asked.
"Looking at these. Check this out."
I looked at the boxes scattered around the door to the shed. Inside was an odd assortment of items. There were boxes of water, flour, salt, and sugar. There was also a box of multivitamins. The most interesting thing was that all the packages had labels in several languages. It looked like the kind of stuff the U.S. usually gave to starving people around the globe, not here. Some of the boxes also had things like baby formula, lentils, and something like cream of wheat, but it wasn't cream of wheat.
"What are you going to do with this stuff?"
Mark was on his knees on the ground, one of the open boxes in front of him. His hands were on either side of the box, and his head dropped down to his chest. "We're out of the food we got from the county. I need to do something for these people. From the looks of it, they aren't going to be very grateful. I think you should put that stuff away for a while. When they're really desperate, they'll appreciate it more." Mark looked up at me, and the expression on his face disturbed me.
"You're one to talk. It's easy to talk shit about food when you're not hungry."
That caught me off guard. It was definitely no longer a friendly conversation.
"Just a thought," I said. I thought we had settled at least some of this the other night, but now it was sounding like Mark was even more in the "let's take Morgan's stuff" camp. I filed that away. I had told him about the tracks we had found at Miss Janice's house and what we did to the trail. He told me to keep an eye on it and let him know if there was any further tracks. I told him I would, and said goodbye. We didn't shake hands. Mark went back to digging around in his boxes, and I headed for the gate. His comments about the food really bothered me, and that was something to worry about. Back at the house, the big girls were busy hanging laundry out on the line, and Little Bit was climbing a tree with a piece of 550 cord. Mel was in the kitchen washing some dishes. I came up behind her, wrapped my arms around her, and kissed her neck.
"Nope," she said without pausing from her washing.
"What?"
She looked over her shoulder.
"Maybe later."
I smiled and kissed her again.
"How's it going?"
"Just trying to get some stuff done around here. How did your trip go?"
"Good. We dropped off the food, and she was really happy to get it. I don't know what she's going to do when it's gone."
"You did what you could. We can't feed the entire neighborhood."
"That's another thing. Tonight we need to move some of our food and bury it in drums. Even Mark is starting to get a little weird."
She stopped her washing and turned to look at me.
"You really think you would come here after it?"
I thought about that for a minute and said, "You might, and that's too close for me."
"Where are you going to put it?"
I'd been thinking about this on the way home. "I think I'm going to take it down to Danny's. We can bury it out in the woods behind his place."
"Well, if you think it's coming to that, then let's do it. I'm not going to let the girls suffer because other people didn't prepare for themselves."
"I agree, but people don't think that way. They're getting hungry and desperate."
"Should we just share it all? Let everyone know what we have and distribute it?"
I looked at her for a minute before speaking. I had thought about this very thing. It might bring us closer to our neighbors, create a little more community in our little world. But I said, "No. If we did that, they would just come back when whatever we gave them ran out. We would never be able to convince them all that we didn't have more.
Right now, they just think we have it. If they knew we did, we wouldn't be able to fight them off. She turned back to the sink and said, "Do what you have to do. You know we're depending on you. No one else is going to look out for us." I thought about what Mel said as I went out the sliding glass door. I was going to go out to the shop and start trying to figure out what and how to cash. The girls were still hanging up clothes on the line, and I stopped to look at them. Leanne saw me and waved, a big smile on her face. My girls were not living the reality of most on our block. They were fairly removed from the suffering all around us,